When your furnace or air conditioner quits, you need it fixed, fast. This is Dennis Sullivan, president of CARE Heating and Cooling. Our technicians are paid to fix your HVAC system, not sell you a new one. We show up on time, diagnose the problem, and get you comfortable again, without the high-pressure sales pitch. It's our commitment to honesty and craftsmanship that helped us win the Lennox Partner of the Year Award and a BBB Torch Award for Ethics last year. So, call CARE Heating and Cooling at 1-800-COOLING or book an appointment online at careheatingandcooling.com. When you need a company you can trust.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
It's the Wonky Show. There's been a spate of students spiking. Is it an unfounded moral panic, or should we be worried? COP's coming up. We'll look at climate commitments made by universities ahead of the summit and the stuff on R&D and specialist provider funding. It's all coming up.
But yes, if you look at the data, and that's why many women are quite rightly outraged, the number of people who go forward with complaints who are rebuffed with, well, you know, things about were you drinking, kind of victim blaming.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Dickinson, and here to help us understand what's occurring this week, a couple of brilliant guests in Westminster. Rachel Hewitt is Chief Exec at Million Plus. Rachel, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, one of the things that I've been really enjoying is getting back onto university campuses and visiting our members. And this afternoon, I'm going to visit London Met, so looking forward to that.
Excellent stuff, excellent stuff. And in York, Pete Quinn is an inclusion consultant. Pete, your highlight of the week, please.
So we've got a family local to us whose son has cerebral palsy during race day recently at York Races, which is usually a zombie apocalypse rather than a sporting event. They were doing a quick fundraising for a new chair for him, which cost £28,000. And just yesterday, we learned that a number of anonymous benefactors have stepped in from that race event and from the publicity, and they've raised the money for the chair.
Good. So, yes, we start this week with spiking. Reports have been circulating throughout the week of incidents of students who've been the victims of both drink and, perhaps more concerningly, needle spiking. And Pete, students are fighting back.
Yep, certainly are. And I think it's just, you know, we don't usually do this on The Wonky Show, but we're probably going to get into some quite uncomfortable and difficult territory in the next few minutes when we're talking about this. But essentially, students having their drinks spiked in nightclubs is not, unfortunately, an unusual thing. And in a previous life as a director of student support, there were always times of the year when that would bubble up and you'd hear about it and lots of students would be coming forward. What's different now is that the sort of coming forward anonymously with lots of shame, guilt and fear around it has turned into a different animal where, quite rightly, there's a lot of rage and anger that this is being permitted or allowed to take place almost, where in supposedly spaces where they have security, CCTV, etc. The different thing is the horrific awareness that people have been ejected rather than having liquid surreptitiously put into their drinks. And there was a really interesting chat that I saw on Pippa Creer, who's a journalist for The Mirror's Twitter feed, of parents saying, we give people cling film circles to put over their drinks. What are we doing here? And there's quite a lot of protests across the country. You name a region or a university and they're protesting about boycotting nightclubs where this is taking place in significant numbers, it appears, currently. Although there's a slight hint of let's just keep it proportional, but let's not forget the fact that sexual assault has been an area of concern, quite rightly so, for a number of years. This isn't a new phenomenon. It's just the way that the drug's being administered is a new phenomenon.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You know, I've read a couple of things today where, you know, experts, kind of medical experts, are suggesting that the kind of needle spiking thing might not be as
prevalent as perhaps the kind of fears that are being expressed around social media might suggest. And I guess, you know, the kind of jury's out on that sort of stuff. But Rachel, I mean, I'm often struck by the kind of work that goes into what we might call the kind of civic agenda, which, you know, tends to be about economic impact and so on. But actually, some of this stuff around interacting with the businesses and the places that students frequent, perhaps from a licensing perspective in this case, becomes just as important, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what you referenced about the sort of medical experts is a good point. But I suppose it plays into the wider environment about, you know, all the challenges we've seen and the concerns about things, you know, after the death of Sarah Everard and Sabina Nessa and the sort of wider environment. And so I think there's more work to be done in this space, and it's not an easy area to address, but I think there's certainly more work that needs to be done on this.
Pete, I see Priti Patel has called on the police to kind of, you know, the old put a report on my desk in the morning thing. But, you know, there's a real question, isn't there, at this point about whether people will and whether they should trust what the police say about the prevalence of drink spiking. You know, I said on the site this week, I certainly in my previous life as a student union chief exec interacted with police who would say, well, it's all made up. It's just people that can't handle their drink. And the trouble is, given the Everard stuff that Rachel references, it is hard to put 100% trust in what the police say about prevalence.
I'd agree with you, Jim. I think there's an important thing to be made here about people who have been impacted by this or their friends and families. There are sexual assault referral centres called SARCs across England. They exist in Scotland and Wales, perhaps under different names. But they are a kind of midpoint between police and also have trained individuals who can support victims of sexual assault. So I think it's important to reference those. But yes, if you look at the data, and that's why many women are quite rightly outraged, the number of people who go forward with complaints who are rebuffed with, well, you know, things about were you drinking, kind of victim blaming. And obviously the impact of these drugs mimic, you know, being extremely drunk and incapacitated. So that's what many people seem to go to. There have been really good examples, though, over the recent years where students' unions, universities have worked very collaboratively with these spaces to provide adequate training and linking with police and other support services locally. So it can be done, but I would be completely understanding of people who have lost faith in the police in terms of the effectiveness of how the criminal justice system receives complaints and processes them. We know there's huge backlogs in the courts from underinvestment, but I wouldn't want people to think, well, there's no point in raising it as an issue. So the sexual assault referral centres, student support services in universities are sadly well used to working in these sort of situations. And there are many local organisations. So the police aren't the single route to get support and resolution in these areas. But the campaign, I would suggest, comes out of a lack of action over a long period of time from police, law enforcement and other authorities in terms of responding appropriately to this.
Rachel, I mean, you know, I've spent part of this week actually for a little bit of work I'm doing with Graham Towell from Durham on I've actually been talking to previous NUS women's officers for much of the week. And, you know, one of the things that has kind of come up a number of times in those conversations is that we still sort of, you know, 11 or 12 years on from NUS's Hidden Marks report, we still lack national prevalence data on sexual harassment and sexual assault, where loads of other countries kind of know the percentages of students that face this and so on. But yet in around the UK, we're mainly still dealing with self-selecting surveys. You know, why is it, do you think, that we still don't really know the kind of depth and extent of the problem outside of this kind of, you know, viral human interest news story version of the problem?
Yeah, I think it's probably partly because it's such a challenging issue to look into for the reasons that you say of, you know, it's a difficult area to do research on. But I think that's not really a good enough reason to not get into. And as Pete says, it's going to rely on a collaborative approach, really. It should be seen as an issue that is everyone's problem and not either, you know, left to the police or left to universities or whatever else. It needs to be looked at holistically. And I think there is a real space for more research to be done on this. So as you say, we get a better sense of what the picture looks like.
And Pete, just before we kind of finish on this, you know, one of the things that was bubbling around perhaps at the start of the week was some debate about some universities' approaches to talking to students about this and that fine line between personal safety information and victim blaming. And that line is becoming harder to draw, isn't it?
Yeah, it's increasingly difficult, and a well-meaning message can sound tone deaf, or you know, in the melee that is this time of the academic year when there's much going on. But I would also point to active bystander training that's been taking place in universities for a while. And if you look at the commentary around this particular issue, where many incidences have been prevented is when male students or male club goers spot something going on and get involved and intervene and either stop it or warn people, which is not a solve all, but let's not wait for research to happen to find out prevalence and why and wherefores. We know that active bystander interventions can be effective, and there's been a lot of work done on that in many universities. So if I was listening to this at home and I've got a kid at university, I'd be speaking to him in particular, saying, if you see something like that happening, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about it? Because people, you know, stand back and let others do it, or are too afraid to act sometimes. So, and I think it's really important that bystander initiative, because how are we going to solve this? It's not someone else's responsibility, it's all our responsibility, particularly men's.
Good. Now, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Alison Watson, Head of School for Leadership and Management at Arden University. My article takes a look at how the Netflix and skill approach can transform higher education. In a society where we get things on demand and are lured in by clever, intuitive algorithms, I decide to explore whether the journey through education should be shaped the same way. The past couple of years have shown us that the higher education system is outdated and slow to respond. I look at how the Netflix model could potentially transform higher education, impacting how graduates fit into their first role post-graduation. I take a look at some of the main issues we are currently witnessing. The job market, for instance, is undergoing a huge shift, and many employers are finding that a big issue is that graduates don't have all the skills they need for their job. I also explore why higher education institutions need to stop being afraid of technology and transformation. With intuitive algorithms, better preparing students than generalised courses, we can give eager learners the education they need and not simply the education they are paying for, ultimately concluding that the Netflix model could possibly guide students towards a course that is not only suited for them, but also ensures that they get all the skills they need to succeed in the workplace.
Now, meanwhile, this week, ahead of the Comprehensive Spending Review, there's been much discussion across the sector and in national politics, actually, about the importance of R&D spending. Rachel, what's going on here?
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, as you say, there's been an increased focus on research funding ahead of next week's spending review. And this morning, we've seen a great new report from HEPI and the University of Lincoln focusing on how we can better distribute research funding geographically. And it draws on some interesting international case studies, such as San Diego and in Sweden, which I think is always an interesting angle to take. It aligns a lot with work we've been doing ourselves as Million Plus. So we published a report last week looking at this area of how we can support the levelling up agenda through research funding. And my colleague Connor McKenzie wrote about it on the HEPI blog yesterday. And we came to a lot of similar conclusions that they come to in this report. So things around scaling up the high fund, increasing knowledge transfer partnerships, expanding Strength in Places Fund, and ensuring that the Shared Prosperity Fund is devolved. And I think all of those areas are going to be really important if we think about the future of long-term research and development funding. And we're all intrigued to see what comes out of the spending review next week.
Pete, it must be tempting for Rishi Sunak with, you know, lots and lots of calls on expenditure, presumably from next door. to kind of put off some of this stuff that's about kind of, you know, investment in our future. You know, that there's a real pressure there, isn't there? Because this kind of stuff is important, but probably not a doddle to sell into, you know, the kind of people who do the two-page layout on the implications of the budget.
I'd agree with you, and it's really sad. So, you know, kind of spending a lot of time internationally in pre-pandemic, the kind of soft power element of Britain, what we were known for was, you know, very high quality research, education, you know, kind of scientific powerhouse for such a small country, effectively. I'm not particularly hopeful, I'm afraid, in many domains around this. I don't think, and you could see recent policy decisions, you know, levelling up is not at the forefront of the actual agenda. You know, it's what they could potentially get away with not funding. And I think universities are not in a strong place. I think we made some good arguments around our response to the pandemic and obviously the vaccines and the other knowledge that's come out of that. But I would argue this government isn't particularly scientifically minded and they're not looking or listening to research a lot of the time. So, you know, I'm afraid I'm a little pessimistic when usually I'm insanely optimistic about many things. Mm.
Rachel, obviously, you know, I guess one of the, you know, one of the things about the stuff you've talked about and the, you know, the report out this week, on one level or another, says, look, there is a considerable concentration of research funding right now, and that has geographical implications, and, you know, the levelling up agenda is fundamentally a geographical agenda, right? But it reminds me a little bit of the widening access debate over the last 15 or 20 years, which is, it's easy to say more poor kids should go to uni. It's much harder to say, let's have fewer middle class kids go to uni. So it's easy to say more research funding should flow into newer universities, for example, partly because of the levelling up agenda and the geography. It's really hard to take that off the current research powerhouses, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that is absolutely true, and it's a challenging issue to be grappling with. I think, I suppose, in the area of research and development, there is a sort of, it's quite a simple argument in that you can see the sort of concentration of research funding at the moment, and there are some quite simple ways in which that can be addressed to some degree, you know, with those sort of funds that I've already talked about. So in some ways it's an easier argument to explain, but I agree that's difficult when there's one pot of money, and how that pot of money is distributed is certainly a challenge. But I think it does it's one of those areas in HE where it does benefit from a sort of a simple-ish argument. It's not as complicated as it might seem.
Yeah. Pete, in an ideal world, outside of the sort of jokey way that I've seen Boris Johnson do this, what sort of things do you think the government ought to be doing to remind us, as taxpayers, that this sort of stuff is a sound bet?
Well, I just thought, if you look across recent times with pandemic, we've got some great evidence that you know, universities across the country have provided really important research, and there's a lot of tech developments that are coming out of different universities around infrastructure, around more effective roads. About, we'll be talking about sustainability shortly, but so there is a broad spread of really effective outcomes. But the other problem is that R&D takes time, and you know, we're in a very rapidly changing, cycling environment these days globally, and there isn't that time to sit and reflect on you know, what's really helped. We hear about all the things that came out of NASA and those kind of large scale research developments, but it's harder to put a good story together about some of the successes in the UK, of which there are many, especially if you read the pink paper on a weekend.
Now, every week on the show, we delve deep into the sector's past to discover stories of how things were and how things came to be. With Nottingham Trent's academic registrar, Mike Ratcliffe, here's the hidden history of HE.
So the government is very keen on modularisation. They like the idea that we can have smaller qualifications that you could take. One of the long-standing issues in the sector has been, what can we do to have a decent sub-degree course? Anyone with a credit framework would be aware that we have a fallback award, another qualification sitting in the way if you don't make it all the way. the Diploma of Higher Education, the DIP-HE. Now, we accept this is a 240-credit award. It's the first 2 years of a course. It's now a fallback award of its own. But this is a comparatively new invention. It stems from the James Committee in 1972. James Committee was set up to look at teacher education. And in an interesting mixture of cost-cutting and philosophical pragmatism, he had this idea that what we wanted was a diploma in higher education as a first stage for those people who wanted to become teachers, particularly for those teachers in first and middle schools, but also those who were going to take non-specialist teachers of adolescents who are needed in secondary schools and FE colleges. Honours degree students could go on and teach the kind of things you might take to A-level, but people needed to be able to teach general things. They'd have a small amount of specialisation, but also a small amount of general studies in them. So this would be good. It was also helpful because the colleges of education that now needed to diversify could offer these DIP-HEs. They didn't have to have the kind of specialisation that you would need for the research part at the end of an honours degree, and therefore they could offer them. They were, of course, also cheaper and quicker. But the James Committee recommendations got caught. Firstly, there were major changes happening to teacher education anyway, but they couldn't dislodge the movement that had already happened in terms of converting certs in education, certificates of education, into the BEd degrees that slowly were taking hold. So it didn't really get picked up that strongly in teacher education. His three phases didn't work. It was too complicated. But the sector was already working away. This was a new qualification. Working parties got going at a national level. There was a large complication about how this would work across the new binary divide, with both universities thinking how they could develop DIP-HEs, but also the CNAA. And the CNAA made the big running on this. They set out the criteria in which you could take one of these courses, and early adopters started to become particularly innovative. This included the North East London Polytechnic School of Independent Study, which offered its DIP-HE in a much broader way, that people could build their own programme and develop their own qualification. The key boost for the DIP-HE was its adoption by nursing midwifery and health visiting as the qualification that they would take. They wanted a short cycle qualification, and so DIP-HEs in those subjects became the, by far the majority of DIP-HE awards, by far the majority of subdegrees probably ever awarded. That was a boost. Now, obviously, they've now moved on to degrees. The DIP-HE is no longer quite the thing it was. But this was still in play when Hefke was trying to boost subdegrees. You could get additional student numbers for offering DIP-HEs, but quickly confused by the introduction of foundation degrees. So DIP-HEs slowly fell away. I went and checked. As far as I can see on UCAS, there is one DIP-HE currently being offered across the entire country as a standalone qualification. And that's at the Point Blank Music School. Now, I might have checked UCAS differently, but in all the thinking about where we go with level 4 or 5 qualifications, all the idea where we go with subdegrees, the waxing and waning of different types of qualifications is there, and the DIP-HE has now had its day.
Now, with COP26 imminent, a group of universities led by Universities UK have made some pledges. Pete, what are they going to do?
So, we've got 140 universities under the umbrella of UUK have agreed some sector-wide climate change targets, and what in effect these means that they've undertaken to cut emissions by 78% by 2035 on 1990 levels. There are a number of exceptions to the kind of the broad response, which has been suggested to be a bit of rhetoric, unfortunately, given that we were just talking about the leading edge research that we've got in this country, particularly around climate change. But the aspirations given by the universities to cut emissions have been the minimum level, the basic level, although you could argue that that mirrors what the government's suggesting as well. Couple of notable exceptions in Glasgow and Kiel, who have gone beyond, the kind of bare minimum. The key thing is there are three target areas that they've got to meet, three scopes they're called, and still there hasn't been an announcement or a sense of what universities are going to do around scope three, which involves international travel, and there's a real tension there between international students
flying over to the UK to study, field work trips, those kind of things, versus our recent experience and knowledge about online learning and how we could reduce emissions. So there's a real tension there around that kind of scope three, as is described, levels. So a bit of a damp squib potentially in terms of expectations. And my thought around this would be that we know that there is that many of our kind of newer students, younger generations are very conscious and very focused on this as an issue. And if your community or your university isn't living up to your expectations, it's another potential area of disquiet and discomfort in terms of studies.
Rachel, you know, I've read critique of this stuff that, you know, as Pete says, basically says, why is the higher education sector kind of matching the bare minimum when, you know, it ought to be, given what it knows about the climate and the kind of understanding it's generated about the kind of scale of the challenge, it ought to be leading the way and, you know, doing much more than the rest of society.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose my counter to that would be that universities have got so many competing demands at the moment in terms of sort of recovering from COVID and with, you know, endless policy changes going on, that I do think it's good that there is space being made for work to be done in this. And I think it's good that Universities UK are pushing on with this work and, you know, not being distracted by the 20 other things going on every day. But I think you're right. I think there's room for universities to do more. And in some ways, I think universities, you know, may look to differentiate themselves to students by showing that they're really committed to sustainability and looking to go above and beyond this sort of sector-wide work. It's an interesting area as something that has largely consensus across, you know, both university staff and across students as an area of importance. So I think it's good to see work going on in the space, and there definitely is work space for more work to be done on this.
I think there's something around disengagement from, you know, your community. It's just another thing to be frustrated about your institution, the way you have your meaning and purpose. And I think it's another thing to get disaffected about is that you're not living your values. I think that might be, there was a thing about divestment and the evidence around that versus, you know, plant a tree, carbon capture, and actually that's not seen to be as effective as it was once thought.
And finally, the Office for Students has announced a consultation on the funding for specialist higher education providers. Rachel, what's in there?
Yeah, so I think this is quite a good wonkish topic. So the OFS are consulting on how they fund specialist HE providers, and they classify those as where at least 75% of students are studying broadly the same subject, and those who have less than 500 students, so quite a sort of niche area. And of course, there's really important work that's done by HE providers in this space, you know, in the art space and the science space. Of course, they are only ever a small proportion of the sort of overall HE providers and student body. And it's quite a different aspect to other universities, because of course, most universities aim to be multidisciplinary and broad learning environments that bring together a range of different faculties. So it's interesting to see the sort of focus in the consultation on these areas. And in some way, there's some legacy issues coming through from Hefke. But I suppose, you know, my interest in this partly plays into how it fits into the wider funding challenges that we're going to see potentially coming over the next few weeks with the CSR coming.
Mm. Pete, what caught your eye here?
It's mainly, I do quite a bit of work with, you know, some independent HE providers, and more recently I've been working with quite a number of small arts and drama organisations around their responses to Black Lives Matter and, you know, just inclusion in general when they're working at such a small scale. So I think what was really important here was about there is a value to keeping these small providers, funding them properly and effectively, because they do create opportunities, particularly in social mobility for individuals. And there are many pathways to employment from them. But the economies of scale argument is the real one here, is that they just aren't able to benefit from existing funding. And it's a real challenge for them all the time, you know, so that it kind of distracts from that core purpose and mission, which is often a very valuable one. And it's, again, it harks back to me again to this kind of soft power piece that we're gradually ebbing away, if it's still there even. You know, we've lost the British Council to a great extent. And these really small specialist providers in the UK really add to that that kind of soft power basis across the world, in that we're still able to sustain them. Many other places never had them in the first place or have lost them. So it's a really valuable part of our kind of education ecosystem, I would argue.
Right. So obviously there are a lot. I mean, there's a lot of very small kind of virtually single subject providers on the OFS register. And, you know, on the site this week, DK has kind of pointed out that, you know, OFS, the outcomes and metrics obsessed regulator, is kind of struggling to find outcomes or metrics that would enable it to work out which of these providers are world leading or world class or whatever it is that they've used in the consultation. This idea of, you know, which ones do you pick out to get their slice of the 5 million?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, this very much reminds me of my time at HESA, where, you know, there were particular challenges for very small institutions in terms of the metrics often just didn't quite work for the way that they operated. And I suppose I'm all for the role of metrics, you know, in the way that we talk about our HE system, but this really demonstrates the need for them being used in context with other wider information, and that we can't just rely on metrics to understand these issues. I think this is going to be a particular one where, you know, we need a broader contextual picture to be able to be clear about how we define world leading.
But that's tricky, isn't it, Pete? Because once you've got a bunch of kind of qualitative, analyses around world leading or world class, or, you know, culturally important or whatever, you know, you're back in that thing, aren't you, about what is valuable to society, you know, which forms of education get to, you know, kind of get the tick. And this is, you know, this is ongoing, has been going on for 2-3 years, bound to be a kind of dominant theme in the CSR. This whole value for money and value thing is never ending, isn't it?
It's really difficult, because how do you know what impact it had? Do you take them all away and see what's different? And that's kind of, you know, there are unfortunately many areas in universities where you just can't quite put your finger on why it's working and why it's effective, unless you just removed it altogether and saw what that would lead to the loss of. I just genuinely, when I, go and work in educational institutions overseas, there is that admiration for many smaller providers who are doing this, what you could describe as a niche work. I absolutely agree. The qualitative piece needs to come to the fore in, I think, these areas. But it is such a shame when kind of metrics overtake value of, and I don't mean the kind of economic value, I mean the real cultural value and the real societal value. And if you just do a spreadsheet exercise on it, you can really lose so much that's valuable. And I would say is really characteristic of, you know, the Great Britain. I it just jars to me now when you see world beating or world leading. It seems, I think, the government, in using that, overusing it on absolutely every metric and dynamic, have kind of taken the real emphasis off. It's almost meaningless now. It's just turned into a tokenistic term. It's a real shame. But I think, you know, we really need to fight for these smaller, impactful cultural institutions. Otherwise, we just lose so much, and you don't realise that until they're gone.
Right, so my other question, right, but particularly in terms of your providers, is, you know, no doubt, if you're a small provider, you've got, like, you know, 450 students or whatever, you know, it's moderately precarious, economies of scale, blah, blah, blah. But in your membership, for example, you must have quite large universities that nevertheless have got kind of schools or departments that are world-renowned, world-leading, probably need a level of subsidy to keep the quality up and so on. And they are, you know, that's not in this consultation, is it?
Yeah, it's not included within this consultation. I suppose this consultation doesn't necessarily mean that those can be supported in other ways. There's obviously quite a focus on small and specialist, but it is interesting about what has driven the focus on small and specialist institutions, when, as you say, some of those areas could be applied to universities more broadly and work going on within universities. But I think some of those messages are difficult to get across. People tend to look at universities holistically.
So that's about it for this week. Remember, to delve deeper into anything we've discussed today, you'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast automatically. Just search for The Wonky Show via Spotify, Apple or Google Podcasts, or wherever else you listen. And to keep you and your organisation ahead of everything going on in UKHE, do head to the website to find out more about our subscriptions. So thanks very much to Rachel, Pete, Mike, everyone at Team Wonky that makes the show happen. And until next week, stay wonky. We'll be right back.